This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
It's really a pleasure to be able to talk about this topic, which I think is really important and sometimes can come as an afterthought. And really, I think the big thing to know is that there are people like me and others who can help with symptoms after treatment or during treatment. And so if you have symptoms, have friends, family, patients with symptoms, it's just really important to know that there are opportunities for improvement. And hopefully I'll talk a little bit today about some of those opportunities, but know that, you know, these are discussions that that we can continue to have. So in terms of disclosure, it's really only related to some funding, which is actually quite relevant here. I do some NIH-sponsored research on how to help patients make decisions about urinary incontinence after prostate cancer treatment. So that's a big passion of mine. And today we're going to talk mainly about some urinary symptoms, mainly incontinence, and then about sexual dysfunction as well. So a lot of people, the first thing that we need to assess when somebody comes and it has urinary incontinence is really to talk about what type of incontinence they have. And there can be many different types of incontinence, and they really help to drive our treatment decisions. So it's really helpful, I think, to just think of this kind of broad overview of incontinence. So you can come and you can see a urologist in clinic because you have urinary leakage. But depending on what's causing it is really going to drive what options we have for treatment. So stress incontinence is something that we typically will see after treatment for prostate cancer, specifically prostatectomy. And that's really a problem where you've lost some muscle tone of the external sphincter. And so usually this presents as people who say that they have leakage when they're doing activities, coughing, lifting something heavy. Even if they have severe incontinence, it can be they're fine when they're lying down at night in bed, but as soon as they get up or stand up from a chair, they're having leakage. Urge incontinence is different and treated differently. Urge is really related to the bladder muscle itself. And so when we think about urge incontinence, we're thinking about overactivity of that bladder muscle. And in the prostate cancer world, I think often we see this either when people have had really enlarged prostates over time, that this is something that develops over time. It's pretty insidious. And so sometimes people say, well, my prostate's gone. I don't have a big prostate anymore. But if you did have a big prostate for a long time, you could develop some overactivity of the bladder. Or we see it in relation to people who've had radiation treatment. Mixed incontinence is also, you know, can happen. And that's really where you have both of these problems and they're treated differently. Overflow is a situation where you can't empty your bladder well, and often this is because you no longer have the sensation that your bladder is full, and so you're leaking because your bladder simply can't hold anymore and it's kind of leaking that overflow. So, you know, whenever I talk to people about incontinence, I always, you know, tell people that even a small amount of leakage can be bothersome, and I think it's helpful to think about the fact that even a few drops of leakage, you know, can be impactful to somebody's quality of life. And so when you're seeing, you know, somebody in follow-up and they're saying, you know, yeah, it's okay. I, you know, have a little bit of leakage, but not much. You know, even that small amount of leakage can really be impactful. And we've done studies here. In fact, Dr. Cooperberg did a study that looked at small amounts of leakage and how much they drive quality of life for people. So it's important to remember that, you know, all leakage can be, you know, bothersome and can be treated. So even if you just think, well, I only have a small amount, you could still be a candidate for treatment. There's lots of different workarounds for incontinence, and you know, some of you may know some of these, you know, pads and diapers, and we can get into all kinds of discussions about what types of those, you know, people use. There's something like the Apex system, which is up on the top left, which is like briefs that you can wear that help collect urine, condom catheters, which are challenging, but some people will use in certain situations. And I think the goal is to know about these products so that you can use them if you want them, but also know that there are also fixes. So it doesn't have to just be workarounds for leakage. Penile clamps are something that some people find really useful. These are literally giving you a device that constricts the urethra and prevents you from leaking. And there are lots of different devices. that are available. We have one that we give out commonly in clinic for people to try that's called the Cunningham clamp, which is the second one down there. But you know, you can go on Amazon and see all different ones. And I actually really like this. This is taken from Dr. Breyer, my partner's research, that shows like what patients really like about these, and it shows the cost of them. So you can kind of see the ups and the downsides. And I've even had patients who have made their own. So in terms of evaluation, again, we're really talking about getting a good history when people come in. And that means we want to understand what your story is. The biggest differentiator in my mind between understanding why someone's leaking, is it stress, is it urge, is it both, is really understanding when they're leaking and how they're leaking. And so those are questions about when the leakage occurs, when it doesn't occur, what things might cause the leakage to occur are really important. Some people only need that kind of information gathering to really understand what type of leakage they have and to give treatment options for it. And there are other people who will need further evaluation to look at things anatomically. Sometimes that can involve urinating and then getting an ultrasound of the bladder to see how well you're emptying. Sometimes it can mean using a camera called a cystoscope, which is about the size of a small catheter, probably smaller than the one that you had when you had a prostatectomy, if you had one, that goes in the urethra and actually can look on the inside at the bladder, at the prostate, at the sphincter. And then I would say more rarely, sometimes urodynamics can be useful. And that's really a study of the bladder function itself, which involves placing a very tiny catheter into the urethra and bladder, filling up the bladder, and then understanding how the bladder functions. So all of these things can be useful adjuncts. In terms of urge-related incontinence, as I said before, this is really incontinence that happens because of a bladder muscle overactivity. And the typical symptoms that we hear when people have urge incontinence are, you know, I had to, as soon as I knew that I needed to urinate, I had to rush to the bathroom. I couldn't get there in time before leaking. You know, as soon as I heard water turned on, I leaked because I couldn't hold it. And a lot of people will say, you know, well, I urinate and then I feel only 10 minutes later that I have to urinate again, even though not much else is coming out. So these are very typical urge symptoms. There are some bladder irritants that you can kind of play around with to see if it helps. And there are some people who find great improvement by eliminating these bladder irritants from their diet. I always tell people you still have to live your life though. So take it with a grain of salt. There are medications, and I would say emerging evidence is really showing that this newer class of medications called beta-3 agonists is really helpful. Anticholinergics were used in the past a lot to treat these symptoms, but had a lot of side effects. And the good news is that these new medications have many fewer, if any, side effects and can be very effective. So that's great news and kind of a newer treatment in the last 5 years. And then there are other treatments too. So there are more kind of a diversity of other options, and you can talk with a urologist to decide if these might be applicable to you. They include posterior tibial nerve stimulation, injecting Botox into the bladder, same Botox that you get in the forehead, but you put it in the bladder, and something like neurostimulation, which can control the bladder muscle, nerves that control the bladder muscles. In terms of incontinence after prostatectomy, you know, this typically when we see stress-related leakage, and that's activity-related leakage, it's after somebody's had their prostate removed surgically. And we know looking at large data sets like Medicare that look at a big swath of our population that about 30% of men will have leakage afterwards. We are very lucky here at UCSF to have excellent prostate cancer surgeons. And so our rates of incontinence here are quite low. But despite that, we know that there are many people who will have leakage as a result of prostatectomy. And we know there are some factors that contribute to this. Age, if you're older at the time of undergoing prostatectomy, you're more likely to have leakage afterwards. If you have a larger prostate, your sphincter length, which is just anatomically kind of what you were born with. And if you've had radiation, that's probably the biggest impact in terms of your continence. We know that you can get improvement up to 2 years out. We have good UCSF data that show that. Although I will say that there's very few people who really get improvement after 1 year. So we typically will tell people that there's this kind of curve during the first year. You'll see some improvement over time, and you will reach a plateau at some point. And some people hit that plateau at 3 months, some at 6 months, some at a year. Very few will continue to improve and hit their plateau after a year. So if you're dealing with leakage, yes, you're going to see improvement until a time, but when it plateaus, if that leakage is bothersome, then, you know, there are options for treatment if that's something that's interest to you. A lot of people ask about Kegel exercises, and this is something that we really emphasize ahead of time and after prostate removal surgery. And really, pelvic muscle exercises like Kegels are designed to improve your pelvic floor. So your pelvic floor is a series of muscles like a hammock, and they support your bladder, your prostate, and your urethra. And your external sphincter is kind of part of that muscle complex. And if you can learn how to activate that muscle complex, you can help prevent leakage. Kegel exercises are best if they're held for a period of time. So if you do a Kegel exercise, you want to try to hold that contraction to strengthen it, and also repetition. So we know that if you do repetitions, just like if you were lifting weights in the gym, you're going to help to improve those muscles. There's a lot of different Kegel resources. And I think at UCSF, we give patients some internal resources. A nice one also on YouTube is Michelle Kenway. I have no relation to her or personal interaction with her at all, but I just think she teaches it in a really good way. And she's from New Zealand, so she has a really nice accent too. So I've heard that a lot of people who like those. Pelvic floor PT, how is that different than Kegels? Pelvic floor PT is really working with a pelvic floor physical therapist who's trained to administer pelvic floor therapy. They can often incorporate things like biofeedback so that you make sure you're actually doing the Kegel exercise correctly. So it can be very useful to meet with somebody to really guide your work in pelvic floor rehab in the beginning, especially. And I will say just one comment on Kegels. We know from data that Kegels can help improve your time to continence. That means after your prostate removal surgery, if you do Kegels, we've actually shown that it improves your getting continent faster. But if you look at the long term, it actually does not change whether you're going to be continent or not in the long run. In terms of surgical treatments, this is a lot of what we do here at UCSF, and there's lots of different options. Everybody asks about urethral bulking because this is something that's done a lot in women, and this is where you inject a substance at the bladder neck to try to coapt the bladder neck and prevent leakage. Unfortunately, there's really no data that it works in men, specifically after prostate cancer surgery. And so although we've tried it so far, we haven't found a good bulking agent that works. There are some adjustable devices that are relatively new on the market. I think those are still, we're accumulating data to understand how well those work compared to our kind of tried and true treatments. So I would say for now, we're still kind of feeling those out from centers that are trialing them. And then the two workhorses and mainstays that have been around for a long time are the male sling and the artificial sphincter. And I think I have just a slide on each. I'm not going to really go into the details, but just to give you an overview, a sling is a piece of mesh that's put under the urethra, and it basically lifts the urethra and helps provide support to the sphincter. So this is really nice for men with mild to moderate leakage. You just get to urinate like you normally do after the sling is put in, which is really nice. Really high success rates in the well-selected population and very high satisfaction. Again, if you're putting it in patients that are well-selected. If you've had radiation, unfortunately, our success rates are much lower with the sling. So that's something to keep in mind. The other workhorse, and I would say what's probably the gold standard for incontinence treatment, is something called an artificial urinary sphincter. And this is a device that gets put in. So because your external sphincter muscle that isn't working as well anymore, this is literally an external sphincter that we get to put in. It has a cuff that's fluid filled. It wraps around the urethra to close it off. And this is all a hydraulic device. So there's no electronics associated with it. It's really nice because it can get pretty much anyone dry or nearly dry. So no matter how much leakage you have, no matter if you've had radiation, this can be very effective. There are definite downsides, and that's always something that we talk to with people, because often when you put a device like this in, we know that you're probably going to end up needing to have a surgery at some point to fix it or replace it or remove it because of different reasons, and then put it back in again. I will say that when we do come across these situations where they stop working or we have to remove them, the question from people always is, when can I get it put back in? Because people like it so much and it's such an impactful way to change your quality of life. So really high success and satisfaction rates. And I put this in, this is from some of the research that we've done, just looking at, you know, who chooses treatment for incontinence. And I think this is important just to say that, you know, often people worry about, they've already had a surgery which has caused incontinence. Why do I want to go through another surgery which has potential for complications? And really, there's very few people who undergo incontinence surgery who are unhappy afterwards. We really see very high satisfaction. And oftentimes people are begging me to say, you know, hey, if you have other patients who are considering this, please let me know. I'm happy to talk to them because it's been such a game changer. I think in the end, choice of whether to treat and how to treat incontinence is a really personal choice. And that's why we're in this quality of life kind of session, thinking about how to make informed decisions. It's a shared decision that you're gonna have with the urologist. And it's important to think about what's important to you as the patient. What are your goals? What are you trying to optimize for? And not everyone is gonna make the same decision. And there are some people even in the same situation with the same leakage and the same parameters and the same characteristics that are going to make different decisions. And that's because they're taking into account what's important for them. And I think that's really critical. So this is a chance whenever I counsel people in my clinic about incontinence treatment, this is a chance that I get to learn a little bit about them and what their goals are, because that's really central to making these choices. Okay, so switching gears to erectile dysfunction. This is very obviously widespread in the United States. I'm sure we've all, you know, heard and thought about erectile dysfunction on the, you know, commercials or otherwise. Prostate cancer treatment is not the only thing that causes erectile dysfunction. So often we see medical conditions like diabetes or vascular disease or heart disease that contribute. But certainly surgery and radiation for prostate cancer can also have an impact. And this, I included this. This is from Dr. John Lindsay, who's one of the erectile dysfunction specialists at UCSF in our department. This is kind of a new pathway that we're implementing here. Dr. Lindsay came back to us at UCSF after doing some fellowship training in infertility and andrology and really thinking a lot about erectile dysfunction. I think it's brought some energy to the concept of kind of rehab around prostate cancer treatment and erections. What can we do before prostate cancer surgery? What can we do afterwards to optimize erectile function? So this is kind of a peek at the type of pathway that's being implemented here at UCSF. And really it's meant to ensure that patients are plugged in even before they undergo surgery to understand, to even start medications that might help their recovery and know what their options are both before and afterwards. So I'll run through just briefly some of the medications that we use to treat erectile dysfunction. I'm sure you've heard of oral medications, the little blue pill and others. This is something that's very effective. It works in response to sexual stimulation. So usually we recommend to patients to take it about an hour ahead of time. Some of these medications need to be taken on an empty stomach to be more effective. And they usually work for about 4 hours. Some of them like Cialis have actually a longer half-life, and so they may actually work for a longer period of time. And really they're meant to be taken not more than once a day. They can have side effects. And so we think about those, especially when we're thinking about cautions with other medications. These medications, unfortunately, aren't always covered by insurance and can be expensive. And so I put two options up there. GoodRx and Amazon Pharmacy actually often have cheaper ways to get these. So GoodRx has coupons that you can take to pharmacies. And that can be a very useful way to get these at a more kind of better cost. Side effects include headaches, flushing, stuffy nose, upset stomach, and dizziness. I'm sure you've all heard the warning about prolonged erections as well. And if you're on nitrates, which are drugs that commonly people may take for heart disease, if they have chest pain, they take a nitrate, you have to be really careful because both the nitrates and these medications can lower blood pressure. A vacuum device is a non-medication treatment that a lot of people find useful. It's really nice because it's very cost-effective and really anyone can use it. It's basically a vacuum that you put over the penis, and either mechanically or with a pump, you can basically evacuate the air that's in this device, and it causes an erection, brings blood into the penis and causes an erection. And then usually there's kind of a constriction band that's at the base of the penis, and this helps maintain the erection. So there are some side effects that are listed there, but there are some people who really like this option because they don't want to take medications, and this is really cost effective. Penile injection is another option, and this is something that we teach patients in clinic to do. So these are injectable agents that can help stimulate an erection. The nice thing about injecting them is that you can give higher doses than you could take by mouth. So often these are similar medications that you might be taking by mouth, but they're in a higher concentration that are delivered by injection. And I can tell you, no one ever wants to put an injection in their penis. I get it. But I will say that for people who this works for, they find that it's actually very easy. You know, we teach you how to do this in clinic, and it can be quite effective. And there's a lot of people who, you know, are really, really like this method. In terms of surgery, there are penile implants as well. And these have been on the market for a long time. And there's a few different companies who make them. There's a few different types of implants. High satisfaction rates from people who pursue these. And often these are people who have tried the other routes that I've already mentioned and really haven't gotten success. And so they end up here talking about penile implants. But there's semi-rigid as well as inflatable devices. And so there's kind of up and down sides of both of those. The semi-rigid basically maintain their rigidity all the time, but you can kind of fold them down. The inflatable ones, you basically have a pump with fluid in it, and you can pump the device up to give the erection. And just here to show you, you know, really high satisfaction rates for people who are choosing these options, both from patients and from partners. And then lastly, just want to say, you know, we're here to help. We have a big team of people at UCSF who both concentrate on helping people kind of post-cancer treatment and pre-cancer treatment with these issues, but we're also really passionate about it. We all do research on it. We all speak on it all the time. So this is something that we really care a lot about. And so I just put some pictures up of who we are and what types of conditions we treat, so that if you ever want to see someone or send a friend in the future, we're always happy to see people. And I think that's my last slide. Oh yeah, these are my kids, because I got to throw them in. You know, any talk I give, got to throw those in. I have an 8 and a 6-year-old.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.